KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
Now includes using small yield nuclear weapons should they be invaded by NATO. It's written in their doctrine. This is to further perturbate the situation with the Chinese, who are taking Mao Zedong's nuclear philosophy and throwing it out the window and thinking, oh, maybe we better build lots more nuclear weapons so we can ride out a first strike and retaliate. This is all because of the United States. It's all because of what's happening in the world post-Cold War that we all thought was going to be more peaceful and is turning out to be more catastrophically
dangerous. Colonel Wilkerson,
dangerous.
Trump just tweeted, just signed bill. He's talking about the spending bill. Our military will now be stronger than ever before. We love and need our military and gave them everything and more. First time this has happened in a long time. Your last 10-second response.
Not the first time. Ronald Reagan did it, 82, 83, 84, and he did it on politicized intelligence about the Soviet Union. We knew it was falling apart at that time, but that didn't go along with his arms buildup. That's exactly what Trump is doing, and he's using the military to gain more votes.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson served as the chief of staff of the Secretary of State of Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. That does it for our show.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Positively Revolting.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO is building a city of media makers. We believe that strong, resilient communities know how to make their own media. For 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, and we know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep the city activated and aware through radio we make together. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
When radio got taken over by advertising, people in Portland decided to do it themselves, and in 1968, they created a space that was free from advertisers and independent from corporate or mainstream media interests, KBOO Community Radio. This is the very essence of DIY culture. KBOO was here in the 70s as people were taking back music spaces, in the 80s when artists were taking back music distribution, and in the 90s supporting zine and small press revolutions and all of the movements of self-expression. Help us build a city of artistic media makers. Long live DIY radio and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers, and thank you for your support of KBOO.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your very own community radio station. I'm Ani, and I am excited this morning to be talking with Dr. David Kempt. Dr. David Kempt is coming to town very soon. He'll be in the region next week presenting his White Ally Toolkit. Dr. David Kempt has worked for the White House during the Clinton administration's Commission on Race. He's also a national expert on dialogue and race relations and conflict resolution. He was called to Charlottesville after the violence there last summer. And Dr. David Kempt, we are pleased to have you with us here on Positively Revolting this morning.
Very happy to be here.
Excellent. Thank you for taking the time to phone in from other appearances you're having in the Northwest, but not in Portland just yet. So thank you very much for making yourself available to the KBOO audience. This is such an important topic. Really, I mean, racism obviously is a matter of life and death. And just like I firmly believe, men have a critical role in ending sexism and sexist oppression, so do I believe that white people have a critical role in ending racism and racist oppression. And I thank you, David, for your work in this area in developing what you're calling the White Ally Toolkit. So let's back up for a moment and talk about what it means to be a white ally in the movement for social justice.
Sure. So part of the approach of my project is to focus on, I think, an underemphasized aspect of the many things that allies could and should be doing. So, for instance, it is important that allies spend time in growing the anti-racist movement. Groups like Showing Up for Racial Justice, and there's some chapters in Portland, and they're all around the country, that the number exploded after Michael Brown's death and again increased after Trump got elected. They often support local efforts, Black Lives Matter or other activist efforts, and people just need labor, people need bodies to show up at protests. That is an important aspect of that work. So there's the movement building work. There's the if racism, the nature of our racial hierarchy, it keeps white folks sort of in the dark about a lot of issues. So that kind of self-education is important to do. It is important. One of the things that I think also is vital and that is underemphasized in the anti-racism movement is the creation of moments of the beloved community where people are not actually doing a task like the things I just described, the movement building, but they're just being in community together. And that could look as trite, potentially, as people having dinner together purposefully across racial lines in groups, or the whole thing of people, stuff like people, the choir, the black and the white choirs sing together every quarter, those moments where people are coming together in celebration, those are important too, and I think underemphasized. A particular aspect that I think is grossly underemphasized in the anti-racist movement and the white ally community is talking to folks that I would call racism skeptics. I try to use the language of skeptics as opposed to deniers, because if I'm talking to somebody who is who doesn't believe racism is real, I want to use language that they might find somewhat respectful. But yes, I think that a lot of people are in denial about racism. I call them racism skeptics. In fact, what we know is that 55% of white folks think that racism against white people is just as big of a problem as racism against people of color. 55%. So what that means is that white folks are split almost in half as a group. And so one of the things I think is underemphasized and that my project focuses precisely on is how do the 45% who, broadly speaking, I will call allies, talk to the 55% who, broadly speaking, I call racism skeptics. I think that there's too many white folks who talk about being woke and talk about checking their privilege and are in their bubble with that is mostly white and a few people of color and are not dealing with their cousin Chase and their Aunt Emma, and you can add your white name here, the people in their family and circle of influence who are the people who are in the 55%. So my project is specifically focused on giving people conversational tools to talk across that divide.
And, in looking at how my personal approach has changed over the years, you know, what you're saying really rings true. When I was a much younger woman, and when I would hear something that was objectionable, that was racist, that denied, you know, the reality, that, you know, what I would consider absolute denial, I would find myself getting very oppositional, one could say. I might say things that could not be said on the air, and you know, say, "You expletive deleted racist, how can you say that? You expletive delete some more.
You idiot."
You know?
You idiot, right?
Right. And I found really that never seemed to work to actually reach that person and maybe shift their attitude.
It's funny how insulting people doesn't move them. It's really weird like that.
It's crazy. Wanting to be effective in my work, had to kind of check myself. And so I started learning a lot about conflict resolution. Now, when you're saying to make language that is more accessible to folks that you're trying to reach who have not come to this consciousness, you know, who are not woke, who, you know, we may find really frustrating, some folks say that if you're changing your language, if you're trying to figure out what they're going to find acceptable, maybe you're actually coddling them or you're playing to their white fragility. How do you answer that?
I want to answer that question, but first I want to say that the first shift is that that's an important thing to do. Like I said, it's great that you were always doing that. There are people who that's their inclination. In fact, one of the things that is in my workshop is for people to do a self-assessment tool, and actually there's a tool on my website, whiteallytoolkit.com, where you can do a self-assessment tool to see how do you respond when there's racist incidents or racism denying statements made in your presence. So you sound like there was somebody who, when that would happen, you would go on the attack. Some people when they confront this, they get on the attack and they go in, and I call those people first responders, because they don't necessarily have a plan, but they're going to take action, and that's beautiful in its own way. But there's a fair amount of people who they don't do that; they avoid talking about it. So I just want to say before we continue with the technique conversation, the first shift is that there's an imperative to engage. And I think but you want to engage smartly. And a whole bunch of people don't engage, and a whole bunch of other people don't engage smartly, right?
Right.
So that's number one. Now, how does one engage? So the fact of the matter is that there's the science of influence. You can look up, Google or YouTube persuasion science, and you'll see that people have studied how people influence other people. And there are strategies and techniques. Salespeople use them all the time, and this has to do a large part of that is how you meet people where they are. And so we can decide that changing one's approach is coddling people to white fragility. But the fact is, on almost any issue, if you're trying to, not just about race, if you're trying to move people's way of thinking, you cannot attack them. That's just any salesperson would tell you that. Any proselytizer would tell you that. Anybody who's trying to spend energy trying to get people to think differently than they already do will discuss how there's a dance that you have to do where the other person might not know you're going to dance with them, but you know, and you're trying to be authentic at the same time strategic in your communication. Now, one of the things that I think people in the social justice world do is we've come up with terms and frameworks and ways of thinking about and talking about issues, and we get very stuck on it has to be just like that. That is the only way of thinking about it. That's the best way of thinking about it. And if you don't understand that, something's wrong with you. And we don't necessarily have a more developmental approach to how you bring people along. Like all of that rhetoric that is valuable, and those concepts are valuable if people already fundamentally believe like you believe. Mm-hmm. But if they don't, then bringing out that rhetoric is not only off-putting, but then the way that people say you have to believe this, otherwise you're an idiot. So I'm not saying white fragility isn't real. Arguably, the point of this project is to grapple with white fragility. I think the people of color raise it more than white folks. So part of the reason for the project is to try to shift that number 45, 55, as we talked about earlier. I'm trying to enlist white people to talk to across that divide and not put that work on people of color to do. Mm-hmm. And one reason is because people of color raise the white fragility issue more than other white people. So, but in order for those white people to be effective, they can't just use the same kind of rhetoric they use at the white ally meeting, because at the white ally meeting, everybody's on board. When you're talking across the divide, people are not on board. So you have to have different strategies.
Mm-hmm. I want to invite our listeners to call in with their questions, with their comments, with their experiences around working for racial justice and becoming better allies and accomplices in the movement for racial justice. The number here in the studio is 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Dr. David Camp this morning. You're listening to Positively Revolting. We're discussing the upcoming workshops in the area, the White Ally Toolkit. David will be in Vancouver on February 17th and in Portland on February 20th with this information and some interactive workshops. I also want to remind you that KBOO's Kickstarter campaign needs your support today. You can help build a strong infrastructure for the next generation of culture workers and DJs. That's you can do that all by going to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help us build a city of media makers. Thank you for listening to Positively Revolting. Again, that number is 503-231-8187. I think that what you're talking about, David, in really changing hearts and minds and needing to check in with our own approach is so important. I think that I hear from way too many white people that, wow, they just get so fatigued and they end up blocking people in their family on social media because they don't want to have this discussion. It's so tiring to have to deal with their racist uncle yet again, you know, and they just sort of try to avoid and live in that bubble world. How can we, you know, challenge ourselves to move from bubble space where we have a lot of head nodding and we feel like, yeah, we're conscious, to doing this work, which is kind of unending and emotionally exhausting?
Yes, racism is very tiring.
Right?
So I understand. You know, I feel the pain of the white allies on that. So yeah, it's tiring. And so, of course, people of, you know, generations of people of color have to deal with that for a long time. So, yeah, it's tiring. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the things, two things. So, first, this is not, this approach is not well suited for social media. Arguably, there's a great thing about social media. I'm a Facebook obsessive myself. However, from a standpoint of changing people's understanding, deeply held beliefs, I don't think that social media is well suited for that. I think that social media trains us to, on the one hand, display our beliefs or our experiences, and it trains us to simply rate other people. Oh, I like that, or I really like that. Like it doesn't train us necessarily to engage each other, there's some arguably deleterious effects of it over time, because instead of engaging people, we learn to just take things impressionistically and respond and let that response be it. So I lament the fact that a whole bunch of people are blocking their relatives and people in their circles of influence on Facebook, but I just want to point out that the principles that I want to lay out in just a minute about shifting the conversation, while you can use them on social media is ill-suited toward having the kind of deep engagement that we're talking about. Okay, that's number one. Number two, you did mention the whole notion of changing language and all of that, and I think that has its role, I just want to make sure that people understand the core shift that I think has to happen to talk across divides.
Mm-hmm.
Is one where you change the conversation from a conversation about opinion to a conversation about experience. That is the that's the fundamental shift. So you got your, you know, your cousin Skyler who thinks that black people shouldn't be complaining about police treatment because everybody knows if you just act right and the cop encounter, everything goes fine.
Right.
So you can go back and forth on that from an opinion standpoint. You can try to break out facts and show that disproportionate portions of people of color are killed by the police unarmed or incarcerated in general or whatever you can break out. However, first of all, there's something called the backfire effect. People can look that up. And the backfire effect basically it talks about the dynamic that when people are confronted with factual information that contradicts their beliefs, they simply double down on their beliefs. So you're not going to get out, you're not going to move people by mobilizing facts. That is highly unlikely. There's a very small portion of people who would be what are called scientifically curious, who are subject to reanalyzing their facts, their opinions based on facts. The vast majority of people don't do that. So so it's not necessarily good to break out facts, and it's not necessarily helpful to break out like logic to try to combat somebody else's logic. What we have to remember is that other people they have their beliefs are as deeply held as ours. So what you want to do is, I'll just say this quickly, I know you have a question or comment, you want to shift the conversation not to what Skyler believes, but to what are experiences Skyler's had that amplify that belief or that animate that belief. So you want to shift the conversation from talking about beliefs to talking about experiences behind the beliefs. And then what you're doing in the conversation is you're using your experiences to jointly analyze, well, what does the world look like? What are your experiences? What are my experiences? And there's a specific sequence I suggest that people do in that, but that is another fundamental shift we're talking about.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated with the idea that facts don't change minds. I like I like being kind of logic based, and after my 20s, I got into being very rational in my dialogue and deciding that if I just armed myself with as many facts as possible, I can statistic somebody into submission. And
again, how's that working out for you?
That didn't work either.
Right.
Yeah. So again, in my own journey, trying to always develop more effective tools for racial justice and other issues I work on, you know, that are all really part of the common thread of a progressive social movement for a better world, that you know, I'm excited that you are coming to town. I want to just make sure that folks know KBOO is a media sponsor of your workshops, the White Ally Toolkit.
We are very grateful for that.
Well, and we are grateful for your work. So I know that you can find information on our website, kbu.fm, on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. And I know that that your workshops are coming up in Vancouver on the 17th. It looks like you have two workshops on the same day, sort of a three-hour intro from 9 to noon, and then a three-hour more experienced workshop, 1 to 4. Can you talk about the workshops that you're bringing to town?
Sure. So our basic instruction workshop is 3 hours, and it's highly interactive. It is not very didactic. There's a lot of talking in pairs, working in groups. I'm a big advocate of and a user of audience polling. In fact, my second book was the only book that's been written about the use of audience polling to make meetings better. That book is called Read the Room for Real. So I use audience polling in my work, and that adds a whole interactive element also. So the initial session introduces, gets people to know each other, makes people aware of the approach that the project takes towards shifting conversations, and then moves people towards practicing on at least one topic, the one thing that is racially problematic that people say. So it could be the thing I said earlier about everybody knows that if you just act right with the police, things will be fine. Or it could be people of color cause their own economic problems. Or it could be there's no advantage to being white, or it could be slavery and segregation a long time ago, why are we still talking about it, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. So the session gravitates towards giving you tools and techniques to deal with one of those issues. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a kind of a self-assessment element as well. So there's a time in which you look at your own response to racism, skeptical statements, and then you get in groups with other people to think about who have a similar response pattern and to think about what are the good things about being in a group like this and what are the growth edges also. So that's like a three-hour experience. So that'll happen at First Unitarian on the 20th of on the 20th, that's a Tuesday night at from 6 to 9, and also at UU Vancouver on February 17th from 9 to 12. Now, I was here in Vancouver about 2 months ago on December the 9th, and so we're having an afternoon, so we had about 70 people. We had a great time, and so there are people who came to that who wanted more work. So what we're doing is having a follow-up session, an afternoon session on February 17th between 1 and 4 for people who came in the morning on February 17th, and so they're basically in this workshop all day, or for people who came to the workshop in December. So it's kind of a part two. So we're going to presume for that one that you have been through the part one, you know your ally type, you've thought about your listening blockages, and you've actually tried a role play on one of the issues, and now we're going to delve more into a couple of other issues and do the same kind of reflection and practice of how you engage on those issues during that afternoon period.
That sounds great. I want to give our listeners a chance to dialogue now. Cody has called in. Good morning, Cody. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ani. Good morning, Doctor.
Hi.
I hope I'm not loud. I was listening to Voices of the Edge yesterday, and this one fellow had called up talking about inherited wealth. Not inherited wealth. He was talking about economics and how I'm assuming that the people behind the mic there were also minorities. I could be wrong. And I was agreeing with everything he was saying about economics and it being the heart of African Americans' problem across everything. And then they seemed to kind of attack him, and I was in 100% agreement with him. And then the host said, "Oh well, look up this one young lady, black lady who died giving birth." And I went, "Wow, even I had to look that up." Mm-hmm. And I looked it up, and it went right back to this fellow's original argument as far as economic, because that black lady was the first person in her generation to have access to a job like that at CDC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm thinking how it's like we have issues with black and white, or at least people of color trying to explain their situation. But then I'm noticing we're having generational issues as far mm-hmm. as communication. How do you convey to a younger generation without them getting on a hostile and defensive side? And you know, because it was like, wait a minute, maybe he used the wrong word. Maybe he should have said inherited wealth, and how it wasn't until 1965 to black. Oh, and one more thing. How the lack of our understanding of our history, post Reconstruction, post World War II, put us in the situation that African America is in right now, as far as inherited wealth. And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Cody, for your call.
Sure. So okay, so part of what that question illustrates is that there's different levels of discourse that we have to manage. So to me, if I understood him correctly, you tell me if I got it wrong, Annie, he's talking about an interaction that happened among people who basically believe that racism is a real thing,
mm-hmm.
and there's some difference of opinion about, you know, what is the importance of economic hierarchies, what's the importance of racial hierarchies, how does issues of health weigh into that, how the issues of wealth weigh into mm-hmm. the racial hierarchies and inequities that we have.
How do we talk across generational lines? Because we know each generation develops their own consciousness and hopefully takes the struggle a little bit further, which can sometimes be at odds with the generations that have got us where we are.
Right. So I think that those complexities are all important from a movement building standpoint. It is important that people on both sides of the generational divide recognize that that generational divide exists, and maybe we need to further develop our discourse of, like, how do you look at these issues, and how is that affected by the fact that you were born in 1980 versus how do I look at it, the fact that I was born in 1961, right? So and that has a lot of implications across a number of dimensions. So for example, a lot of people my age find that people significantly younger are kind of they're more upset by the fact that white folks still going to be white than might be necessary, might be good for their own health, right? Because of psychological health, because and it's a good thing that people have the expectation that people would things would be different. But I was told, I'm from that generation. I mean, my parents grew up in the Depression, and they had a whole different thing, and so they're telling me, don't trust white people, and white people are always going to let you know that eventually they will let you know that they're white and you're not. And so my expectations tend to be kind of low, right? So I'm not as upset. I'm not as prone to getting upset by white folk going to be white as people who are much younger. And part of me goes, come on now, let's remember what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a 400-year-old problem. It's not going to be solved very quickly. So I have to learn to be more understanding of, like, what does it mean to grow up much later in history and have a whole different set of expectations that then you see are thwarted. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to get to is a couple things. First, within the realm of people who already believe racism is real, there's going to be still difference of opinion, and we have to allow each other grace, and we have to try to bring our a broader understanding of the differences within us around that. But I just want to point out that that is a different conversation than the conversation you have with people who don't think racism is real. And part of what I think is that part of the point of the project is to try to train people who are in that 45% to do what black folks have had to do for hundreds of years, which is code switch. You talk one way when you're black folks. You talk one way you're talking to the man. You have to talk, you're talking a different way you're talking to the brother man, right? Because you have to learn how to do that. I think allies need to do the same thing. They need to talk one way when talking to other allies or people of color in the anti-racism struggle, and a different way of talking to people who are not on board with that. And you have to be strategic in how you communicate. So what Cody was talking about were the complexities of that within ally conversation, and we need to give each other the grace on that. But that's a whole different kind of conversation, talking to people outside of that who challenge your presumptions, don't have the same data, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, let's go ahead. And I know we only have you for about another 8 minutes or so. And maybe you'll be able to come back, maybe not, before the end of the hour. So I'm very appreciative of your time, Dr. Cool. Kemp, this morning. Let's go ahead and try to get Kelly on the air right now.
Hello.
Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi, Ani. How are you today?
Doing well.
Can you hear? Great. I want to go back to the personal experience message and just touch on that. I'm walking across the bridge if I'm out of breath. As a white mother of two African-American children, I think it's important for us to relate our personal experiences, especially as white people. We have that responsibility because we're a little bit of a more well-received messenger, a little bit, and relating those personal experiences, even when I tell what someone would consider a very aware white person who has been raised by hippies that my daughter is being chased home and being called you effing and you know what, and so are my employees, my black female employees. There are people that are out in our streets right now, mm-hmm. verbally threatening and attacking the person who killed those two people on the mat.
Yeah.
Tried that with my daughter 3 days before. We need to share these personal stories in a way that is personal. I'm hurt. Listen, what happened to someone that I know?
Yeah.
And touch each other in that way. And that's all I want to say. And I appreciate everything that this man is doing, and I appreciate you having this show today.
Kelly, thank you so much for your call.
So let me say, can I add, thank you so much for that. Let me add something to that. So first of all, two things. First, I think that white folks who are parents of people of color or just in the same family have a special opportunity to be effective, because I mean, as the caller said, white people are more credible to racism skeptics when they talk about racism in general. But white people with people of color in their family have they're particularly likely to have experiences that they have either that directly happened to them or their children or family members, and that has a whole different level of credibility. So a couple years ago I did a transracial adoption camp, and I was talking about the potentially special role of white parents of children of color. So I applaud that caller, and I think that for doing that and for recognizing that her role is very important. Further, I think that like all of her friends who are allies need to really learn her stories that she's having, and then they can relate those stories secondhand, because the relation of secondhand stories can be very effective too. Yeah, I know a friend of mine's daughter is having X, Y, or Z, and they can bring that conversation. They can bring that. Mm-hmm. That kind of experience to the conversation, and that can be effective too. White allies have to be much more strategic and about the business of putting together their own personal toolkit, so when they face the skepticism about racism that they are already confronting, they are armed and ready. And so part of what my project is about is envisioning that people, if they're going to really play a role in addressing racism, need to kind of prepare. They need to prepare their toolkit, which is why it's called the White Ally Toolkit. So that, and it's not just a one-time thing. Going to a workshop is fantastic. We want people to come to it, but it's a longer engagement than that, because just like I've had to prepare to be a person of color, and so preparing all my life. If you're really going to be an ally, that's a constant preparation process. So I applaud people for wanting to engage that, and I hope people come to the workshop ready to enjoy it. We have a good time too. I don't think race work needs to be unpleasant. As I tell people, we're not in the no fun zone, we're in the pro fun zone, but we're still about the business of becoming more effective.
Very nice. David, I know you have to leave very soon. Do you have time to engage one more caller, or should we?
Sure.
Okay, let's go ahead and have Dave. Good morning, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Hello?
Yes, Carrie.
Hi.
Carrie,
go ahead, bro. I think we all ought to get brave when it comes to racism and white supremacy and just get right down into it. I think it's that fear of genetic annihilation. I think it goes all the way back to the 40s when they kept black people and white people separate so they couldn't race mix. What do you think? Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your call, Dave.
I think that's reasonable. We could go even more. Another aspect of that is something called a racial threat. Racial threat is the anxiety that a group has when it fears its political, economic, or cultural power is about to diminish. When I try to raise racial threat to white people, I remind people that if we think about L.A. in the 70s, or Brooklyn in the last 10 years, or Harlem or Austin, or even parts of Portland, mm-hmm. Black people can experience racial threat. So it's important to make the concept generalized. I think that white people nationally are experiencing racial threat. A whole bunch of white folks are recognizing the coming brown tsunami, and you can see comments about that, or people, you know, with people like Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, talking about our civilization won't survive by raising other people's babies. So you have a whole bunch of people who are worried about genetic annihilation is one frame. Political racial threat is a different. It's a similar outcome. People are worried that they will no longer be in the same kind of power. So part of what has to happen is that white allies need to start talking about that, and start talking about that not from a blaming standpoint. Part of what I but from a different standpoint. From a yes, it's almost the I too am racist, and that's a strategy. Oddly, white allies need to almost get in touch with their own racism and start being honest about it, to invite other people to be honest about it too. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a key to the conversation. So part of what my strategy, the techniques in our program do is to encourage people to do that, give them strategies for how to talk about that, how to tap into their own stories. It is important that people be able to tell stories that connect with a racism skeptic before they try to expand. Our strategy is basically, the core issue is, the method is the race method. You reflect, you ask, you connect, then expand. And ask means you ask other people about their experiences. Connect means you tell them a story that validates some little piece of their experience before you try to expand their thinking by telling them a different story where you try to expand their view. Most people try to go right to the expand, and they don't connect first, and that's why they're not effective. So there's a lot here to think about, and my hope is that people will come out to our workshops and recognize this is it's fun and the beginning of a lifelong journey of becoming more effective. Our goal of the project is to move that 55-45 divide, to flip it to 55-45 the other way in 7 years, by 2025. That's going to take tens of millions of white people, white conversations, where no people call in the room, but those conversations have to happen from people having a strategy and being effective, not doing the same old thing and getting the same old non-result that they've been getting.
Dr. David Camp, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We will continue on this conversation until 9 o'clock. We hope you have a chance to rejoin, and people can get more information about your work at whiteallytoolkit.com, yes?
Yes, they can, and we're so grateful that Cable would co-sponsor these events. And we're grateful for your listeners, and let's hear it for the white allies. We need more of them. We need to be more effective, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. David Camp. Let's go ahead and talk to another listener now. We'll give that number out just another time here, so you can call in with your questions and your comments around becoming allies, making our work more effective, how we engage difference in opinion as we dialogue, how do we win hearts and minds in this super important area. Again, anti-oppression work is something that we need to weave into our work every day, whether you consider yourself an active community activist or not. It's something that we have a chance to engage in with our families, with our neighbors, with our community members, in our daily lives. And it's really important that we take every opportunity to interrupt oppression where we find it. So that number to call in to dialogue this morning on the air, call in with your questions and your comments at 503-231-8187. I want to let folks know that coming up on KBOO this morning at 9 o'clock, the beloved community welcomes Glenn Montgomery, who is the executive director of Vision Action Network. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views speaks to organizers from Changemakers Conference in Corvallis. It's a platform for women to enhance their activism. At 10:15, you can listen to Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, The Digital Divide. Hears from experimental electronic music artist Christy Denton. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. It is an important way to support the work of independent community radio and make sure that we continue to be able to provide the tools for changing the world to a better way, a better place to be, into the next generation and the generation thereafter. KBOO celebrates our 50th anniversary this year, and I hope that you have had a chance to check out the exhibit at the Oregon Historical Society. It opened on January 20th, and it will continue into July, so you can really get a sense of KBOO's place in at the crossroads of so many movements and its importance as a community radio station. And the work that KBOO does around radical inclusivity is really part and parcel to this conversation this morning. I want to let folks know that we have a monthly discussion group here at KBOO where we talk about becoming better allies. It's the Beloved Community in Action discussion group. And we have started showing a movie here at KABU for discussion purposes on the third Thursday night of the month. So that's this month. That is going to be a film called Real Injun. And that is looking at stereotyping of Native American communities in Hollywood, and looking at the reality and the stereotyping that exists. So that is at KABU, and that is free and open to the public here as just what we do as community members every day in our work to make the world a better place. So 503-231-8187 is the number to call to have this conversation and continue it. What's your experience in dialoguing with folks that you might disagree with? It is so important to be able to reach out and actually talk to folks who have radically different ideas. And I was sharing a little of my experience and my techniques that have failed in the past. And I'm really curious as to what you find works for you. Also, I'm curious about, you know, if you have stayed silent when you realize maybe you shouldn't. That's also important to talk about, and successes that you've had when you feel like you've actually made a difference when you talk to somebody. Again, the number to call, 503-231-8187. You can also, I want to say, like Positively Revolting on Facebook. You can find us there. facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. You can also follow us in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. And it's, I think it's important to really, again, dig deep. As Dr. Kempt was saying, it's important to code switch, to understand that different techniques, different language are going to reach out and actually help us connect with different people. And in order to do that, we have to be really aware of ourselves, our triggers, and we have to stay centered. We have to stay looking at what's going to be effective versus what's going to make us feel really good and vent our righteous anger in that moment. I think that that's one of the mistakes I had made in the past. And I think it's important to realize, oh, the wise words of Leah, my high school psychology teacher, when she said, do you want to be right or do you want to get what you want? When we talk about things that are so important, like ending oppression, like racial justice, like confronting racism where we find it, I think it is important to understand that the effectiveness of those actions, those words, those conversations far outweighs the that immediate sort of adrenaline hit of being able to know that you are morally superior to the person you were talking to. That just really doesn't help anyone after that moment. I think it's also super important to realize that to some degree, we have all been socialized to hold oppressive beliefs. They may be deeply subconscious at this point because we've done good work, right? And I'm specifically talking to other white people around anti-racist work. We know that it is not okay to be racist. We know we want to be good allies, but if we don't actually look at ourselves and confront each other when we err, then we are not actually moving the movement forward. And that is ultimately super important. And David has been able to rejoin us. Good morning again, David.
Hey, hey, hey.
Welcome back. We have James on the line who is, he's calling back in just at the right time, I gotta say. Good morning, James. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great, you're on the air, and so is David. So fabulous.
I was hoping to ask him a question. I was really disappointed when he got off the line originally. No, my question is because I kind of joined the conversation late listening to this broadcast. But is it specifically for white allies, or do you run a separate workshop to help people of color to be able to talk to talk to white folks, because that's I get really, I know that a lot of it is because we look at different facts, and like she said, we, like Ani said, we've been taught as a culture to hold oppressive beliefs. But I'm finding that, like, I would like to be able to talk to white folks about this. With, I mean, and my anger, my initial adrenaline rush and my ability to control it has gone down, but I feel like I need more tools to be able to have that conversation, because like you said, we got to develop different language when we're talking to those we wish to bring in the fold that are for the most part, at least in my experience, unknowingly complicit. So
right. So just to be clear, I've been doing racial dialogue work for like 25 years. So I have been in numerous sessions of, you know, people talking across racial lines. So it's not like I haven't done that work or don't do that work. But what's happened in the past year or so is I've recognized that after the I look at the election as a massive white ally fail, because a whole bunch of people were talking about how woke they were and how much they checked their privilege, but they're not talking to, you know, Emma, Chase, and Skylar and their whole families about the fact that we have a candidate who was clearly at least racially problematic, and that should at least be raised as that. So, given that, my focus has shifted to this, so helping white allies talk to racism skeptics in their own circles of influence. So, while as a general matter, I do cross-racial work, the White Ally Toolkit is specifically for it's not just white people, it's white people who think racism is real, to give them guidance and support in engaging the 55% of white folks who don't think racism is real, some of whom are in their own families, neighborhoods, workplaces, etc. So just to answer your question, this project has not, while I have done cross-racial work in the past, this project is specifically for white folks to learn better how to influence white folks in their circles of influence who look at racism very differently.
Okay.
Am I answering your question?
So is there... Yeah, that does actually. Is there anything you could recommend for somebody who, like, I'm Mexican American. I want to talk because I have a lot of white family. I have a lot of white people that I work
around.
You should
come to the workshop. I mean, it just I'm not saying it's exclusively for people of color. Not with people of color. We've tended to have somewhere on the order of 10 to 15% of most of our workshops are people of color who hear about it and who want to learn about it, and so. I don't know if you would be called as white presenting.
I'm definitely white presenting. Absolutely.
Then the workshop's for you, brother. Because part of first it's for everybody, because again we've had 10 or so 15% of people of color attend the workshops, because what we teach are principles of communication that are grounded in conflict resolution, nonviolent communication, and persuasion science. So it's not like you walk away with only dealing with racial issues. The underlying principles of how you engage a conversation, how you structure a conversation to be not about opinion, but about experience, and then how you sequence that in order to move somebody, right. those apply in other areas too. So so for people of color out there, you know, the techniques, there's a generalizability to it, even though the specific context we focus on white folks, because that's who we're trying to influence. So, but for you, since you, first of all, white presenting, and second, are have a whole bunch of people in circle of influence who are white, who you have frustrating time talking to, you would probably find our workshops very appealing, because it would speak right to you getting a hold of your frustration and how to channel that frustration into more energy, but use more strategically to be more effective.
Yeah, okay, that's great. I'll try. And you said it's whiteallytoolkit.com?
Right, and yes, so whiteallytoolkit.com, go to the events page. You can also go to KBOO and learn about it. Again, it's next Saturday, and then it's also the following Tuesday. Next Saturday morning, okay. 9 to 11, and then the following Tuesday, 6 to 9, and then there's a if you really like it, you go to the first one. I mean, then you can sign up if you know you want to stay. Then there's one in the afternoon where we go even deeper and deal with more racially problematic things people say.
And Saturday's workshop on the 17th, it's February 17th, not tomorrow, but a week
from,
in Vancouver, and then Tuesday
it's
the 20th,
right.
And then Tuesday the 20th. Is downtown at the First Unitarian Church, 6 to 9.
Correct.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Great. Yeah, keep up the good work, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks, James. Dr. Kampt, there's something that you said right before you left for that sound check, and I just want to get back to it for a moment. And that is, it's important for white people to actually be in touch with our own racism, our enculturation. And, you know, I know that I was raised in an adopted family. My mom always said, I don't have a racist bone in my body. And then she would proceed to, you know, engage in a whole lot of stereotyping. And,
right.
You know, and so that's one thing. We know that as white people, we have to say, no, we're not racist. And we often are afraid to look deeper than that. And here at KABU, where, again, we engage in radical inclusivity, where we have hard conversations with people around these ideas as part of our daily work, still, I hear every now and again, as the volunteer coordinator, I actually have a full-time job here at the station. I'm one of the few paid staff. I will have a volunteer come up to me and say, you know, there's somebody in the music library. I don't know them. I don't know if they should be in there. Oh, okay, I'll go check. Thanks for letting me know. I have never had that person be a white person. I have never, you know, it is always a Latino or an African-American man that right. is in the library that somebody is concerned about. And so, again, how can we challenge ourselves to look at our own... these people are with the struggle. They believe that racism exists, and it's a bad thing, and they are fighting it, but they don't see how they themselves are holding it. How do we engage?
Well, part of what has to... Right. So part of what has to happen is we have to make it safe. White people have to make it safe for each other to talk about these biases that still affect us. I think that one of the things I think has happened in the past several years is the emergence of the term unconscious bias in terms of popular parlance. This was first really done by James Comey in 2015 when he was the FBI director, and then Hillary Clinton raised it again in the debate. And I think that term, I've said since I worked for the White House in 1998, that if we could get that term in popular discussion, it would shift race relations work, because it's important that people have a tool to talk about how they can be affected by these societal images and stereotypes in a way that doesn't blame them but holds them responsible for what they do. So I think that the unconscious bias idea is something that is critical, and what's important for people like you to do is to be able to tap into, like, how might you be affected by unconscious bias, going back to your mom and the kind of messages that you were exposed to and that we're all exposed to. You exposed to them directly from your mom. Mm-hmm. And then what you want to be able to talk about is how those still might affect you in just a microsecond, mm-hmm. in just a moment. And you want to be able to bring that to bear in a poignant way to invite other white people to admit the same thing. Part of the reason why 55% of white folks don't believe that racism is real is because we're in a kind of a collective denial, including a denial about themselves. So part of the way that we fight that is for people who are in the 45% to say, you know, it's not to point a finger at you. No, you're a racist. No, it's like, you know, in fact, I still have this issue. Despite my commitment to racial equity, et cetera, I still cross the street when some young black guy's up ahead, or lock the car door, or whatever that is. And what you want to be able to do is to find stories that poignantly bring that, so that it's hard to deny that, and you're inviting other people to do the same thing. So it's a weird thing. Like, on the one hand, we're trying to not do these things, and we don't want to support that part of ourselves. But the irony is that the way to get to make progress societally is to start admitting it and be more public about that, and to talk to people and invite them to say, does that ever happen to you? And then just and make it okay for them and safe for them, even if they've done worse than you. So there's a weird kind of an irony that the way we get to more love is to admit the parts that are kind of hateful. And hate love is a little bit dramatic on that, but you see my point. We have to admit how we're falling short in order to do better.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for spending your time with us this morning. Dr. David Kampt, presenter of the White Ally Toolkit workshops coming up in this area on the 17th and the 20th. You can get more information from whiteallytoolkit.com, or from the KBOO homepage, as we're a media sponsor, KBOO.FM, and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Thank you so much, David, for taking your time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for thank you and thank KBOO.
I want to also thank you so much. I want to thank Ray, our board op this morning, for doing a great job. And I also want to let you know that coming up on Tuesday night, Sylvia Federici will be speaking in town, also a KBOO co-sponsored event. You can get more information on the right side of the homepage. Sylvia Federici, an amazing revolutionary freedom fighter, will be speaking in town at a forum called hashtag Me Too and New Forms of Capital Accumulation. That's Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock at the SEIU Hall on 64th and Foster.
Beloved Community in Action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. right here at the radio station. On February 15th, we'll show the film Real Injun, a Canadian documentary film that explores the portrayal of Native Americans in film. Real Injun is illustrated with excerpts from classic and contemporary portrayals of Native people in Hollywood movies and interviews with filmmakers, actors, and historians. Again, that's a screening of Real Injun for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action movie night on Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Kyle Carrezzi, reporter and producer for the KBOO Evening News. For decades, KBOO News and Public Affairs has welcomed radical and spirited activists in the Northwest and beyond. As Oregon evolves, KBOO is central to connecting